Good evening. 5 years ago, this day, September the 11th, was seared into America's memory. 19 men attacked us with a barbarity unequaled in our history. They murdered people of all colors, creeds, and nationalities, and made war upon the entire free world. Since that day, America and our allies have taken the offensive in a war unlike any we have fought before. Today, we are safer, but we are not yet safe. On this solemn night, I have asked for some of your time to discuss the nature of the threat still before us, what we are doing to protect our nation, and the building of a more hopeful Middle East that holds the key to peace for America and the world. On 9/11, our nation saw the face of evil. Yet on that awful day, we also witnessed something distinctly American. Ordinary citizens rising to the occasion and responding with extraordinary acts of courage. Since the horror of 9/11, we've learned a great deal about the enemy. We have learned that they are evil and kill without mercy, but not without purpose. The war against this enemy is more than a military conflict. It is the decisive ideological struggle of the 21st century and the calling of our generation. Our nation is being tested in a way that we have not been since the start of the Cold War. We saw what a handful of our enemies can do with box cutters and plane tickets. We hear their threats to launch even more terrible attacks on our people. And we know that if they were able to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, they would use them against us. Osama bin Laden calls this fight the Third World War. And he says that victory for the terrorists in Iraq will mean America's defeat and disgrace forever. If we yield Iraq to men like bin Laden, our enemies will be emboldened. They will gain a new safe haven. They will use Iraq's resources to fuel their extremist movement. We will not allow this to happen. America will stay in the fight. Iraq will be a free nation and a strong ally in the war on terror. We can be confident that our coalition will succeed because the Iraqi people have been steadfast in the face of unspeakable violence. And we can be confident in victory because of the skill and resolve of America's armed forces. Every one of our troops is a volunteer, and since the attacks of September the 11th, more than 1.6 million Americans have stepped forward to put on our nation's uniform. In Iraq, Afghanistan, and other fronts in the war on terror, the men and women of our military are making great sacrifices to keep us safe. Some have suffered terrible injuries, and nearly 3,000 have given their lives. America cherishes their memory. We pray for their families. And we will never back down from the work they have begun. We also honor those who toil day and night to keep our homeland safe, and we are giving them the tools they need to protect our people. We've created the Department of Homeland Security. We have torn down the wall that kept law enforcement and intelligence from sharing information. We've tightened security at our airports and seaports and borders. We've created new programs to monitor enemy bank records and phone calls. Thanks to the hard work of our law enforcement and intelligence professionals, we have broken up terror cells in our midst and saved American lives. 5 years after 9/11, our enemies have not succeeded in launching another attack on our soil, but they've not been idle. In the first days after the 9/11 attacks, I promised to use every element of national power to fight the terrorists wherever we find them. Our nation has endured trials, and we face a difficult road ahead. Winning this war will require the determined efforts of a unified country. And we must put aside our differences and work together to meet the test that history has given us. We will defeat our enemies. We will protect our people. And we will lead the 21st century into a shining age of human liberty.
Welcome to the David Shaler Show, or Truth Radio, as we like to call it. And that was George Bush giving his presidential address on the fifth anniversary of 9/11, which has obviously been a weekend of enormous interest to me and my friends in the 9/11 truth movement. But there were some pretty shocking things that seemed to come out of that speech. It seems to imply that what we've been saying is true, that we could be in a state of perpetual war as long as we have our troops, American troops, illegal occupying countries abroad. But I can't believe the chops, bro, this man talking about the struggle for civilizations. Or what sort of civilization is it that has something like Guantanamo Bay? What kind of civilization is it that tortures people, quite often innocent people, taxi drivers picked up in Afghanistan or whatever, and then tries to claim that somehow they are protecting our freedoms? But I think the most absurd claim has to be that the world is either a safer or more secure place. It's quite obvious to anybody who watches even the mainstream media that we live in a world of chaos and darkness like we've perhaps never encountered before. And this is directly as a result of the illegal invasions of countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. And believe me, if they had their way, they'd be in Iran as well. It's only because people have stood up to them and made it difficult, or in fact nigh on impossible, for them to invade Iran by marshalling public opinion and just showing how barbaric these invasions have been. It's also been a quite strange week for me, because we actually managed to get something into the mainstream media in the New Statesman, which is obviously a very, very small circulation magazine for the kind of people who think themselves independently minded lefties, basically. Needs to say, like everything else on the left, it's sort of slowly, it's actually in fact moribund probably. But anyway, this guy called Brendan O'Neill came round to interview me, and you know, Brendan, I'm going to send you recording this, really, because I'd really like to ask you what you're playing at. I mean, why would you come round and interview people who are seeking the truth and then not actually do any research yourself? Why didn't you read the books we gave you, the DVDs we gave you, all of which make a very, very convincing case for 9/11 being an inside job? And why would you choose to try and divide the movement or make ridicule of the movement by choosing to lead with one of the most controversial theories, shall we say, around 9/11. But let's forget about 9/11. No matter how controversial any theory is, it's quite mad anyway for the Americans to kill 3,000 people in broad daylight in downtown New York. And that's the leap he's got to make. But you've got to wonder why people like him do this. Why would they seek to discredit a growing truth movement at the moment without actually doing any research? I mean, I can understand this if we were talking nonsense, but he didn't even do any research. In fact, he tried to discredit me by referring to a photograph that I'd never had a chance to comment on in the article. And if he had, of course, referred to that, I would have been able to tell him that the photograph did not show parts of a 757 at the Pentagon. They showed parts of what was more likely some kind of military plane. So even in situations like that, we could quite easily have corrected what he had to say. But he pulled the trick that tabloid journalists do, basically. And this is that they all sort of, you know, go and interview you. They'll select information. They won't do any research. And then they'll introduce ideas that they'll pretend they've put you and they haven't, to make you look stupid. But, you know, anybody can do that. But, of course, no person of principle would do that, would they? Anyway, I would say to Brendan, please, you know, come round and see us. We would love to brief you with the stuff you haven't seen. You know, everybody can be saved. But I would also ask you to look at your own conscience, basically, because people in the world are dying as we speak, unnecessarily, because of illegal wars predicated on 9/11. And if we can expose 9/11 for the inside job of it is, the whole war on terror and the whole war on freedom end. So, Brendan, which side are you on, mate? Anyway, today I've got some people from the 9/11 movement with me here in the studio. I've got Justin Walker from the Cumbrian 9/11 movement. Hi, Justin.
Hello, mate.
And I've got Ollie Marshall here from the Brighton 9/11 movement.
Hello there, Dave.
And we've got Callum Douglas here from the Oxford 9/11 movement. So we've got a bit of the sort of spread over the country here, just to show that, you know, we're not just a few sad people in bedrooms in London, basically, in Totnes, in fact. But first I want to talk to Callum, actually, because Callum's actually done some great original research, which he showed me yesterday, which he got actually from the US government under the Freedom of Information Act. And it concerns really the flight path of Flight 77. Now, I've always been concerned about this because these people take off from Washington Dulles Airport. And rather than slamming the plane straight into the Pentagon, they go halfway towards the Midwest. Then they disappear from the radar. Then apparently an object's picked up that's supposed to be Flight 77 coming back. But anyway, they've now released some information to Callum under the Freedom of Information. Tell us a bit about this, Callum.
All I did really was just reading The New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin, excellent book, and just looking at the references at the back. And it mentioned the flight path studies, which were compiled by the National Transportation Safety Board in America, Washington, D.C. Now, they're obviously responsible for investigating any aircraft that crashes in American territory, so obviously quite well versed in the procedures with a large team of flight engineers who dedicate themselves to investigating these things.
So what are they actually claiming these flight paths are based on?
Well, there are a lot of documents in the flight paths. Most of them consist of PDF documents, which have all sorts of references in it. Some of them are from the radar data, which gives you altitude, speed and so forth. A lot of it, slightly anonymously, seems to be apparently from the black box, which is slightly odd because we one had actually been found. But
that's right, because one of the astonishing things about 9/11 is that these black boxes, which are, you know, are designed to be indestructible in an airline crash, have little transmitters on them to make it easy to find. All four of them that day went missing, didn't they? Well, that's as far as we understand anyway, yeah?
Indeed, yeah.
So they're claiming this is based on a black box that we don't know anything about.
Well, it suddenly appeared after 5 years, and they have a purpose-built software program, and quite simply all they do is plug the black box into the computer with the software program, and it will, from the data, generate a flight path in three dimensions, which is basically a bit like a little bit like you're looking at a computer game.
Well, this is what we were watching last night, wasn't it? It's like a kind of simple sort of 1980s computer game.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. The graphics are very basic, but it's just give you an idea of what the plane was doing. Gives you the instrumentation from the cockpit and so forth. And this is one reason we know it's in the black box, because it has things like throttle position, yoke position, etc., which you obviously couldn't possibly ascertain from the radar.
All right, but there's actually, and we've actually, and this is an exclusive here, we've actually got another 9/11 smoking gun here, haven't we? We've actually figured out we've probably got about 300 of these. And if people aren't clear what you mean by a smoking gun, this is a metaphor. You know, when you see a dead body on the ground, you see the man holding the smoking gun, chances are he's the one who's done it, basically. That's the evidence you're not going to be able to explain away. Well, we reckon 9/11, there's probably about 300 of them, but this year, here we go, 301. Tell us all about it.
Well, basically, what you see is that Flight 77 sitting on the runway, all the way to, almost hitting the Pentagon. And the entire thing lasts for, obviously, about an hour. So I speeded it up so you can watch the whole thing in about 5 minutes. And watched it two or three times and didn't really think much of it. But the last frame is actually the crucial one. It shows the plane about to hit the Pentagon, and below you can clearly see the motorway where the poles were knocked over by the object that hit the Pentagon. Now, I looked at it and thought, something's not quite right here, and it soon became obvious what it was, because the altimeter, according to the black box, was reading 180 feet. So the question you have to ask yourself is, how precisely do you have an aircraft at 180 feet simultaneously skimming at near enough head height over the ground, knocking over light poles? Now, my first reaction was, well, we have to check the ground level at the Pentagon, because obviously the altitude is above sea level. We did.
So I think this is really clever. I think that's really clever because I would never have thought of that. I think that's sort of brilliant lateral thinking.
It's approximately 40 feet. So this then takes it down to 140. And we looked at the poles, and they're approximately 40 feet tall. So that we can take another 40 off. So we've then got 100 feet of air in between where the black box says the plane was and the top of the poles. And it's just irreconcilable. And we have the CCTV images in which the nose cone is clearly visible, passing horizontally across the lawn, and yet the black box data says the plane was nowhere near it. So the question is, purely logically, either the CCTV images are correct or the black box data is correct. They both cannot be correct.
Well, they both could be wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what increasingly look like. I mean, we've all seen the pictures, and I think we pretty much agree that if you see anything in the side of that picture in the close up, it looks like the nose of a Sky Warrior, isn't it? Yeah.
A3 Sky Warrior.
Sky Warrior, yeah. And certainly that's consistent with the kind of turbine thing found within the Pentagon as well, isn't it? And I think you've done another graphic as well, haven't you, trying to show what a 757 would look like if it was if you sort of take the building and a mock-up with the sort of a 757 in relation to the Pentagon.
Well, that's right. I managed to obtain an AutoCAD model of a 757-200, which is the exact variant used, which is a three-dimensional model, and then constructed a very basic three-dimensional model of the Pentagon, superimposed a raster image of the satellite images which are available at the Pentagon, and we know where the CCTV camera was to within a few feet. Within AutoCAD, you can place cameras, so you just place the camera in the correct position, put the model on the flight path, which we calculate from the geometry from the hole through the Pentagon and the light posts, put the plane on this path and see what it looks like. And, it's too big.
And you also actually have the absurd idea of a civilian jet airliner actually flying you know, in parallel to the ground, which is obviously impossible for a jet airline to do. When a jet airline is close to the ground, it's you know, it's at an angle to the ground. That's how we all know you land in a plane, now you take off in a plane. For a plane of that size to be going on a few feet just above the ground straight is a physical impossibility because of the downward G's, I think.
Well, I'm told by a new organisation which has just formed in America called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. I'm reliably told by pilots with tens of thousands of hours in 757s for all sorts of major airlines, that quite frankly, if you were ploughing through the air at over 500 miles an hour at that altitude, it would just have nosedived into the ground within a very short space of time. The idea that it passed over the lawn without touching it is farcical.
And of course, this flight path also shows, isn't it, is that obviously much, much earlier the plane sees the Pentagon. And then, of course, rather than just taking the plane straight down, of course, as any terrorist would do, they do this rather nice little sort of 330-degree manoeuvre, which means that they hit the one side of the Pentagon that doesn't have any military personnel in because it's being renovated. That's right, isn't it, from the...
Oh, exactly, exactly. I mean, the other ridiculous point is that, obviously, if you were going to do this, you would obviously scope the area out. I mean, whoever was going to fly the plane would have probably, if they were sensible, driven around the Pentagon in a car years or months beforehand to see a likely approach route. And what they chose to do, in their infinite wisdom, is choose the one dominated by lampposts and motorway signs. not really the basis for a sort of, you know, your professional hijacker, really, you have to say.
Yeah. And on the subject of the Pentagon, we're still, you know, with one of the questions that we put again, which we think is one of these smoking guns, is the Pentagon's automated anti-missile defence system. That anything not sending a friendly fire signal, which of course a civilian jet airliner wouldn't, would be automatically shot down. So the only thing that would get through that is either a military plane or a US missile that's sending out a friendly fire signal. And that to us, again, is absolute proof. I can't see how they can argue that away. Or perhaps they're going to tell us the Pentagon doesn't have an anti-missile defence system. I don't know. Perhaps they'll try and tell us that. They'll just try and tell us that all these tax dollars were part of the $2.3 trillion that went missing from the US defence budget and was announced by Rumsfeld on the 10th of September 2001. So that's why you've got no defence system. You see, the New World Order's stolen all the money. Anyway, so just to sum up on that, I mean, we're absolutely clear. I mean, this is it. So we have some information now coming out of the Pentagon, Freedom of Information Act. Nobody can dispute the sourcing of this or anything else. It's come from them. And, you know, to sum it up, really, quite frankly, it's a load of bollocks again. It's another smoking gun because it shows that the plane is at least 100 feet above those light poles. And of course, the other thing, of course, as well, is that, you know, commercial airliners are not made to withstand things like hitting lampposts. If a wing of a commercial airliner hits a lamppost, the wing will start to fracture and the plane will go down immediately. It probably wouldn't have even reached the bloody Pentagon. And of course, the other thing, of course, we have to say about this as well, wasn't it, about the thing, which I remember this, is that in that simulation, it doesn't actually go right to the end, does it, as such?
No, that's correct. The data apparently stops with the plane. I've done the calculations. It's several hundred feet from the face of the Pentagon. The data apparently stops. I also just like to add, before anyone gets any ideas, that this data has been emailed to several people all across the globe. So it's a bit too late if you've got any clever ideas in that line of thinking. But...
Yeah, no, well, we've got to think about these things, haven't we? I mean, I don't think in our position we can ever be too careful. I mean, I always say, you know, in my case, you know, you're not actually paranoid if they really are out to get you, basically. Anyway, it's been a great weekend for the 9/11 truth movement in general. We had... a talk by David Ray Griffin, the author of the New Pearl Harbor and the 9/11 Commission Omissions and Distortions, and I was on the platform speaking with him, but we packed out the Conway Hall in London. We had well over 500 people there. We were sort of turning people away at the door, and of course, as a result of this, we sold a lot of books, a lot of DVDs and so on, and there was a real sense that we really are getting this message out there. Two stories to relate in the run-up to that, though, or the run-up this weekend, when we do other events as well, we had problems with the anti-terrorist police. In fact, the anti-terrorist police tried to go to the... Well, in fact, indeed, went to the club where we were putting on a promotion on Sunday evening in support of 9/11, and tried to intimidate the club into giving everybody's name and addresses, basically, including those of the musicians and so on. Now, what the hell are the anti-terrorist squad getting involved with, a club night in Brixton carried out by people who are in search of the truth and in search of peace? Same thing on the demo we had on Monday. A number of our people were questioned by police, had their names taken under the Terrorism Act for doing things as dangerous as taking photographs, basically. But about the David Ray Griffin thing, I thought he was, a tremendous talker. I thought he actually came over very well, very witty. I must remember as well, you know, how much stuff in the new Pearl Harbor there really was to open my eyes to 9/11. I think in many ways, you know, obviously you've got to go and check the facts afterwards, but you read David Ray Griffin and it's such an eye-opener. It's such a comprehensive and in sense as well, in-depth exposure, even though it's quite a short book and a very easy book to read. It's very, very, in fact, very simply written. So what are everybody else's impressions of David Ray Griffin, Justin?
Well, as I said, I was completely overwhelmed. I didn't even get a seat. I was sitting on a step, a bit hard. But it was just, I mean, as I say, I really feel we've reached a turning point in the movement now. I think 9/11 truth is due to become totally mainstream within the next few months, if not now. I think it's just a matter of time, very short time, in fact, before the first MP raises his head or her head above the parapet in Parliament to ask the right questions. We know Michael Meacher knows. I mean, after all, he wrote the foreword to David Ray Griffin's book. He's told us he's biding his time. He will choose the right opportunity to go and launch it. I know of two Liberal Democrat MPs now who are really on board. Privately, they admit they have real problems with the official story of 9/11. So I am really upbeat. We're getting a lot of support. Even at the demonstration yesterday, which I have to say looked really impressive with all the placards and everything. I felt that the whole thing was absolutely wonderful. And we had one policeman, I think, actually came up to us and said we were very well behaved, a bit patronising perhaps, but he also said, I agree with every word you're saying. I know, it's an inside job. So, yeah, absolutely marvellous. And then we all disappeared over to the BBC and stood out there, and a small delegation of us went inside. And of course, we didn't get very far because obviously they weren't going to invite us straight up to the newsroom.
They were pretty desperate to keep us away from journalists, I think we're fair to say, wouldn't they?
I sometimes, do you remember, what was it, a few years ago when lesbians were, I can't remember what it was, but somehow they got into the BBC studio.
Yeah, I remember.
I sometimes wish we were a little bit more in that direction. I would have liked to have tried to have got in and said, no, hijack the news for that day. But never mind, it was very orderly. Again, a lot of support, cars tooting their horns as we went past. And no, I have to say, it was a brilliant day. And I really do think we've turned the corner.
Yeah, I mean, about the demonstration on Monday, I mean, just to make it clear what this was, a demonstration of 9/11 truth outside the American embassy. We were kept locked out of the memorial gardens, even though we were there to pay our respects to not just those who died in 9/11, but obviously all the victims of the war on terrorism. Obviously, many people in Afghanistan, well over 100,000 in Iraq, have died in this conflict, and we were paying our respects to all of those people. But of course, we got the mainstream press did take a bit of interest because they were there and asked a few questions. I've not seen if we've got any coverage. I don't think we have. But of course, the question they put to us, isn't this disrespectful to be here today? And we were saying, well, we're entitled to show our respects. But what we crucially want, of course, is for all these dead people, the dead in America, the dead in Afghanistan and Iraq, is we want justice for them. And the only way we'll get that justice is by exposing 9/11. But there was a third reason why we were there. And that was to protect the people who are as yet alive, but living under the risk of being killed in terrorist conflicts. Because, as I say, if we don't act now, in future, those people will most likely die in some terrible conflict. Because really what they want is the Third World War. And I see this more and more when I see stories in the press about the Pakistani ISI trying to being held responsible for the attacks in Mumbai on the 11th of July. And you think this is the New World Order planting stories, trying to whip up nuclear war between India and Pakistan, basically, and they will stop at nothing. So, little demonstration, what else did we do? Oh, it's the events. We had some workshops and a sort of gathering on Sunday as well. Somebody want to talk about that, Ollie?
I didn't actually see much of the workshop. I was quite busy networking with other people in the movement. I'd like to comment on the Griffin talk. I thought that night really showed me how much the 9/11 truth movement has grown over the last couple of years. It really has. It's just astonishing to see how quickly this thing is growing.
Yeah, it was. Well, a year ago, it was. We all met up in a sort of squatted church, didn't we, Justin?
That's right.
Down in
right.
Tufnell Park. And it was really a sort of collection of people just come together, really kind of in a sense of, well, what can we do about this? Because obviously they're trying to keep it out of the mainstream media. But to think how far we've come in that year, I think, is extraordinary. I think you're absolutely right. Saturday night was a real testament to the ingenuity and intelligence and cooperation of the movement.
And even at the protest on that went on yesterday outside the embassy, and especially the BBC, people driving past in their cars and beeping, you know, and then you've got Loose Change 2 screening across the Europe on God knows how many TV channels.
That's right, isn't it? Because we know the guy who's got the European rights to that, hasn't he? He's been telling us. Yep. So tell us about a bit more about this.
Well, the most amazing thing is, for me, is Loose Change 3. The size of this film, the scale of its intended release is phenomenal. This thing is going to like literally blow up across America. I mean, a film like Loose Change 2, even with a major distribution deal, would be amazing. But Loose Change 3 is probably going to have God knows what new research in, new video footage maybe, exclusive interviews. And as I say, with a mainstream cinema release, it's just going to, people are just going to find out now.
I think, in fact, I was told that some of the footage is going to be in Loose Change 3 is that famous one with Dick Cheney, and the guy keeps coming in and say, the plane's now, was it 5 minutes out?
Yep.
Do the orders still stand? And apparently that guy who's actually that guy getting this, you know, couldn't understand why the vice president wasn't, you know, behaving as he should have done. That guy has testified. So if that's the case, it's going to be a pretty powerful piece of kit.
It was Norman Mineta, if I'm getting his name right. But with regards to the, just to hijack the conversation, excuse the pun, for my own ends. we have been in contact with Dylan Avery about the new Pentagon data, so he's in possession of it. Whether he chooses to insert any of it into Loose Change 3, I don't know, but you may well see it in there. If not, it's on YouTube already.
It's on YouTube, all right, so get it on YouTube. Oh, fantastic. Well, that's great news. We're getting something into, if we can get a little bit like that in Loose Change 3, that would be fantastic, Callum, so well done. The other thing, of course, we do have on a lesser scale than sort of cinema release is our own production of Short Change, which world premiered the other day.
It had its world premiere.
At the gathering in Brixton, the mass in Brixton.
Yeah.
Because I'm down with the kids. Well, can we talk a bit about that?
Well, it's basically just a British version of Short Change 2. Sorry, Loose Change 2.
Yeah. We're short changed.
Which is obviously narrated by yourself.
Yep.
And hopefully it will just really appeal to the British audience, perhaps even the American audience, seeing it with a British narrator.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is it. I mean, I think Alex Jones, for example, does an excellent job. But I think in this country, we're always a bit scared of people who are a bit in your face like that. They're the kind of people who go and bullhorn Parliament and then kind of bullhorn you in the television set, basically. And but, you know, I'm not criticising him in any way. I think it's a fantastic job he does. And I like that sort of style personally. But in this country, we tend to sort of think of the BBC being the voice of authority. So we like to hear sort of measured English voices rather than hearing American voices when we want to hear something that we think is authoritative and reliable. I think that's probably a fair comment. But Short Change has got a few bits added to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's a few extra scenes in there. I think my brother would be good to comment on a few of those, perhaps.
Owen, do you want to talk a little bit about the extra scenes?
Oh, hello. I didn't know I was going to be.
But you've also got Owen here, who's our sound man, but also a member of the 9/11 Truth Movement. So he's actually also the editor of the programme, does just about everything else.
Hello. Okay, well, one of the extra scenes is a clip from Rick Siegel's film, which sort of confirms the controlled demolition theory. You hear all the booms, and you know his footage definitely confirms that, you know, that it was more than just a plane taking down those buildings.
That's the 9/11 eyewitness, isn't it?
Yeah, Hoboken. That's on Google Video or whatever.
And he takes the images from the other side, doesn't he? So it's actually a completely new
view. It's from across the river in New Jersey.
Yeah,
Hoboken. Yeah. That's in the title, isn't it?
Very rarely seen angle.
It's not being seen elsewhere.
Normally it's just close-up stuff around the towers, but seeing it from the other side of the water, you get an idea of what's where in the air, and it's a very interesting angle.
We've got another great bit, haven't we? Talk a little bit about the Larry Silverstein bit.
Is that clip not in Loose Change?
No.
It's not, actually. One of the only decent ones that isn't in it.
Yeah.
Well, for some reason...
Oh, I didn't know that.
You must have put that in.
For some strange reason... well, I'll start that again.
It did put it in Loose Change, yeah.
Loose Change 2 didn't actually include the rather disturbing clip of Larry Silverstein, the building owner of the entire World Trade Center complex, Building 7 included, which came down at 5:27 p.m. Massive building, 47-story skyscraper. Probably one of the biggest smoking guns for me.
We saw this last night when we got somebody to phone at the Islam Channel discussion, didn't we? The two presenters were trying to be sceptics, and we got somebody to mention Building 7. You could see clearly in their faces that they had to deal with something, and they'd recognised the smoking gun. I think that would be a fair comment.
I think David Ray Griffin handled it extremely well on Saturday night about the comment, you know, to pull it, and how, you know, Silverstein tries to make it sound as though he's telling him to pull the contingent out of the number 7. Well, the contingent had already been pulled out hours before.
Yes, he says in the clip, we had the contingent pulled, and then the building came down, doesn't he?
I mean, then the building collapsed. I mean, yeah. It's quite clear, if anyone has any elementary idea of English, even the Americans, the way, you know, with English, when you say pull it can only mean one thing. I mean, that is common jargon in the demolition industry. I've heard it used many times. Even when good old Fred Dibner, who admittedly brings his chimneys down in a more spectacular way, cutting them out, he uses the word pull. I've heard it pulled. I mean, you know, we're going to pull this chimney. It's just a way of saying it's coming down.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, there'd be any doubt about that. So not only do we have the whole smoking gun of the fact we have this 47-story skyscraper just apparently a collapsing of its own accord, more or less, due to a few very small fires that even the officials don't accept is a good explanation of why it came down. We actually now have the site's owner confessing to the building being subject to controlled demolition.
And it would take about 2, 3, 4 weeks to set a building up that size for controlled demolition.
And it really doesn't take a genius to work out that there's absolutely totally identical to what a controlled demolition would look like.
Collapses in the centre, you see the roof line in the centre collapse, and then straight down.
Right, it's got a footprint.
Classic crimp in there, you know.
And as you say, I mean, I just don't understand how people can see any of this and not think there are the very least there are questions that need to be answered.
I mean, yes, we must admit, though, equally, there were about 2 or 3 very small fires, asymmetrical, in the building. And yes, when the two towers did collapse, it had damaged one corner of the building. If there had been a partial collapse down one side or something like that, fine, no problems.
Yeah.
But the fact it was just symmetrical, straight down the whole thing, no nonsense. It just, I cannot understand anyone still trying to justify the official theory.
Well, I think it's important to put it in perspective, because the trouble is Building 7 being next to the Twin Towers, which at the time were the tallest buildings in the world, you forget how big Building 7 is. Now, if you imagine Canary Wharf being decimated in 6.5 seconds, I would imagine there would be some architects in London with some questions to answer. Just imagine Canary Wharf being decimated into tiny little bits in 6.5 seconds.
Well, it actually withstood a bomb blast.
Yeah, it did, yes.
It was an IRA bomb blast. Owen, you were actually up at some basketball match or something, weren't you, when that went off?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, all the glass was blown from it, but, you know, it's still there.
Yeah, the structure doesn't go. All the bits attached to the structure go, but not the actual structure itself.
I wonder, actually, just come in and aside, my parents are true blue conservatives, and I thought, my God, how are they going to react when they know I'm involved in the 9/11 truth movement? So, but my mother said, oh, no, we think those towers... We saw the architect being interviewed, the architect of the World Trade Center. We saw him being interviewed the day after the attack, and he looked horrified. He looked incredulous. He could not believe that his creation collapsed like that. And my mother said the expression on his face told her that something was very wrong. Yeah. So, you know, he obviously felt, you know, hey, this shouldn't have happened. And, of course, it shouldn't have happened unless, of course, you had explosives all the way up. So, no, it's as far as I'm concerned, no steel frame building anywhere in the world has ever collapsed because of fire. And again, this weekend, you see so much of the fire that when the planes hit, the kerosene is burned off. Yeah, I mean, the bulk of it is just burned off. I mean, and so where's this fire? So,
yeah, and of course, this is the great thing I keep mentioning as well. I keep coming back to the great smoking gun to me is those hot spots taken from satellite thermal camera. Showing a hotspot on each of the sites of where Building 7 was and the North South Tower and the South Tower. And I say, the only explanation I can see for this is molten iron, which is, of course, a byproduct of thermite when it slices into the steel in the structure. That's the only explanation for that. And that's why, of course, the 9/11 Commission don't deal with this at all. That's why the NIST don't deal with it. FEMA don't deal with it, basically.
I still think the most compelling evidence still is William Rodriguez and the fact he had to give his evidence behind closed doors to the Commission.
Yeah, can we just sort of, mention a little bit about that? Because we saw this last night on the Islam channel, didn't we?
Yeah, and well, that guy is totally honest. And, you know, we've heard him, of course, when, you know,
Jimmy Walker, I mean, I've actually met him.
Met him. And, you know, nobody dares to address. I mean, that guy witnessed explosions going in the basement, and he saw one of his mates come up, skin dripping off, you know, and this is before the first plane had hit.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, exactly. And this guy's absolutely clear about the explosions. He says these are not the planes hitting and so on. He's there. He's an eyewitness. He's obviously the janitor who worked in the World Trade Center. But he's also quite aware of some of this stuff because he was actually the janitor when the first World Trade Center bombs went off in 93 as well. So he has some experience with this kind of thing. And again, you say, why? Why is this man giving evidence behind closed doors to the 9/11 Commission? Yeah. And why haven't they included his evidence in the final report? And it just appears that they chose this idea of Al-Qaeda. Anything that doesn't fit in with that just doesn't go in the final report. And I think the most astonishing is that the 9/11 Commission don't even mention Building 7.
Hello.
You know, there is no mention of Building 7 in that report. And I just, you know, this is supposed to be a full account of what happened that day. You can't miss out the collapsing of a 47-story building, really, can you?
Well, I think what it's interesting you mentioned the report again, because one of the things that David Ray Griffin came up with, and I think it's something we as a movement are going to embrace, is the setting up of a European Truth Commission to really put the official conspiracy theory to test. We will provide our evidence to appointed commissioners who, you know, decent, upstanding people in Europe. We don't know who they are yet, but obviously that's something. And we'll ask the other side to put their case and then let it be judged. And I think David Ray Griffin's call for such a commission, a truth commission, is something that we've really got to take on board and get started with.
Yeah, and I think this is the way forward. I really do, a truth commission. Now, obviously, we didn't have any powers of subpoena, but I think it could be very telling if we offered pay people generous expenses to come across and testify, and they didn't do that. Yeah. We could then, you know, say, well, why won't these people answer these questions? And rather than in a way now a jury is allowed to infer something from silence, we certainly be able to, I think, infer that they couldn't answer certain questions that we want to put to them, basically.
And every day we have an every right, because how many British people died in 9/11?
67. 67, which is obviously people, more than 77. In terms of British loss of life, it's probably must be the greatest terror attack in history, because most of the people on the plane in Lockerbie, because were Americans going back to America.
That's right.
So on the whole, I mean, the 9/11 Truth weekend, I thought was absolutely excellent. I thought the movement really put themselves on the map, and what I thought was particularly interesting, because people have talked about the movement being, because it's a movement, being sometimes very, very disparate. I mean, one of my members said it's a bit like trying to herd cats. And I thought yes, particularly yesterday at the demonstration, I thought that we handled ourselves very well, because we were herding cats. We all just about managed to stay together and somehow go to the demonstration, all get our placards out at the same time, all managed to show the right respect. We insisted on obviously putting our placards down while the memorial service was going on. That was all obeyed. Nobody spoke out of turn. And I've got to say, at the end of the demonstration outside the American Embassy, because we weren't allowed in the Garden of Remembrance, we laid white roses around a tree and sang "We Shall Overcome," which I found very moving.
Might be an idea just to say why we laid white roses, because I think that was quite an interesting one.
Yeah,
that Annie found out.
The White Rose Society in Germany was one of the resistance movements to Hitler, and I'm sorry, the name of the woman involved escapes me now, but I saw a film about her, and basically she was a student, and basically just sort of handed out a few leaflets about how the Nazis were losing the war, and this was becoming quite obvious to the German people that it was all going wrong. And basically she was arrested for this. She was then put in front of a German court and sentenced to death for doing so, for treason against the German state in time of war. And I think part of her calculation might have been that she always thought that they took 99 days to execute you in Germany, but in this particular case they just took them straight out and execute them that afternoon.
Guillotine.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was bloody and, you know.
People do say that guillotine isn't actually the most humane way of killing somebody, in fact. I think there's any humane way of putting somebody to death, quite frankly, but that's what they say is the most humane way of doing it.
I think Socrates had the best death. I mean, he was allowed to have an orgy first, and then he was asked to drink the hemlock when he was completely pissed.
Yeah, no, I think that would be quite a nice way to go.
Yeah, I mean, if I've got to choose, I think that's probably the way I'd opt for it.
So the White Rose Society was saying, yes, the White Rose is a symbolism of basically standing up to the Nazis. And, we're really not too far away from that when you look at people being taken off and tortured, and you look at Guantanamo Bay concentration camp, and you look at the massive prison building program going on in this country that I keep going on about, and nobody seems to want to report anywhere, but this is going on. It's a matter of public record, and yet, according to all the records, crime is falling. So why are we doing that for? And it's quite obvious that the elite, whatever you want to call them, the Illuminati or the Zionists or the New World Order, have realised that they haven't taken the people on this particular journey with them, that we are standing up to them. And, we're not actually believing the lies of their multi-million-pound media industry, which is all there, of course, to create hatred and division. And as a result of that, they are going to put the refuseniks in prison without trial. That is quite obvious to me. And so even if you're not concerned for your own health and safety about all of this, your own security and peace of mind, what about the future generation? They're going to have to pay the price for your lack of action if you don't get out there and do this. Now, there's a point I made in the speech on Friday night, in 5 years' time, the democratic structures may no longer be there for us to gather together and have meetings like that and have our voices heard. So the time to really stand up is absolutely now. The time is not to think about it. The time now is to absolutely do it. I'm just going to get the door. Yeah, we're saying that 9/11 had come of interest to the anti-terrorist squad as a result of an event we organised last Sunday. But one of the members of our movement has actually been in trouble with the police, in fact, for trying to place a bet. And we're going to hear a bit more about this from Oliver Marshall from Brighton 9/11.
Hi, this is Ollie Marshall reporting for the David Shaler Show. Joining me here is Sean King, aka Frog. Frog, recently you decided to place a rather unusual bet at your local Ladbrokes. Could you tell me a little about that bet?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if it was really that unusual, to be honest. I basically went into the Ladbrokes, been chatting with a friend, and I'd read an article about the 75 professors who felt that the collapse of the World Trade Centers, including World Trade Center 7, was the result of a controlled demolition, and he suggested I put a bet on. So I went there and tried to make a bet, or at least inquired to see what my odds were, and they wouldn't let me make the bet. They said it was a novelty bet. So basically, I thanked them for their help. They said try a private bookies, and I went off for a coffee.
What happened in the events recently after?
Well, yeah, after going for my coffee, as I say, I was sort of like on a lunch break from work and basically sitting there in a cafe. In fact, I mentioned it to a friend of mine that I bumped into there. Within about 10 minutes, four police officers were ambling down the aisle of the coffee shop towards me and came up to me and said, were you just in Ladbrokes? And I said, yes. And of course, I put two and two together at that point. Then they said, can we have a little chat with you? Yeah, so these police officers caught up with me in the coffee shop, and after confirming that I was the guy in Ladbrokes, because I guess Ladbrokes had called up and said that there was a suspicious bet that was made, when I put two and two together, they decided to, obviously ascertain who I was, and then, basically asked me the question, why did you make the bet? Because I went through the whole story with them. And, basically my reply was, well, have you read the newspaper today? There was an article in the Daily Mail going on about the 75 professors, the Scholars for Truth, I think they're called. And there's also been loads of stuff on the internet. And that's basically what I said to them. I just said, have you looked at the internet recently? Have you, have you read the newspapers? And, there was obviously they took a great interest in my story, and I was there for an hour. They wouldn't let me make a phone call to call my work and just let them know where I was. So it was a pretty shocking experience, to be honest.
Well, I'm wondering is your bet actually not null and void, as it has been proved, or has it been proven scientifically possible already that the towers were brought down by a controlled demolition? If you look at the work of Steve Jones, perhaps?
Yeah, I know Steve Jones.
So perhaps your bet would have been void in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I've been thinking about this, obviously, since the experience, and sometimes I'm almost coming to the conclusion that almost truth is what we believe it to be, and if there's enough people to believe something on the basis of some evidence, then that perhaps becomes the truth. But for the moment, obviously, in terms of what we define as the truth, perhaps in terms of the collective consciousness, I think people are pretty much in the dark at the moment about this sort of thing. So perhaps to make the bet that I made would seem absolutely ludicrous to a lot of people.
Okay, Frog.
Including the police.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like you were the police actually perhaps overreacted a little to the event?
Well, I mean, I understand, obviously. I suppose they've got a job to do. It's a pretty hyped up, jumpy world, as even they pointed out to me at the moment. And I suppose given the time, of the year, maybe they just had a job to do. But yeah, I guess what surprises me in a way is just that, you know, there's all this information out on the internet. There's plenty of media and interviews for people to go and look at and research for themselves. And I don't know, just sort of maybe I was a bit naive in making the bet, but it just sort of strikes me as kind of odd that the people in the police force just aren't aware of it, you know. And that, I think that's kind of worrying, actually. I mean, I think they should keep a tab on what people are talking about and looking at,
and perhaps know what it's already about.
Well, one would hope, yeah. I mean, that's what police are there for, really.
And Frog, you were actually at the Griffin event on Friday. How do you think that went?
Yeah, that was pretty amazing, really. It was great to be there, actually. Griffin was a great speaker, and
So you think the truth is well on its way out by now?
Well, I don't like to be blindly optimistic. Certainly, I get the feeling that this story really does seem to be breaking a lot of ground at the moment. And personally, I mean, my major interest in this sort of thing is the truth. You know, I think looking to point blame at particular individuals or whatever is not necessarily going to help humanity at the end of the day. We need to understand the psychology of our species, and certainly just looking for the truth and getting it out is one way of perhaps healing some of the hurt that's on this planet at the moment.
Frog, that's absolutely brilliant. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Cheers.
Yeah, Callum, you were telling me something else interesting you'd seen, because there is this famous article, isn't there, in Popular Mechanics, which is called Debunking 9/11 Myths. But you heard the guy, I think it was the editor of the magazine on a programme, discussing the DNA identification of the bodies. That's right, yeah?
Yeah, well, that's right. I don't believe it was actually the editor of the magazine, but he's certainly the spokesman the magazine put forward as an authority on this particular piece. And, of course, this article's always mentioned when you immediately discuss with anyone sort of into any sort of engineering or anything like that. They say, oh, well, you know, this Popular Mechanics article is a very well-respected magazine on the subject, and they think it's nonsense. Well, just to sort of give you an indication of the sort of calibre of investigation they'd done into it, they had a whole series of radio shows planned, and the chap came on and was made to look really extremely silly indeed by the manager of the radio show, who really just was asking fairly normal questions. And probably the best one was that he said, well, what about the BBC reports that 6+ hijackers are still alive? And he said, well, I don't give them any credence. And Zender said, well, why not? And he said, well, because we have identified all the hijackers from DNA, so we know their identities and they're dead. And the radio presenter said, well, that's fair enough. That's very interesting evidence. He said, surely, though, you can identify DNA from remains, but what do you cross-reference it from? Where did you get the samples of DNA from before to identify that these DNA samples are from these people? And there was silence for 10 seconds on the show. There was a very awkward silence. And the poor bloke didn't know. He did not have the faintest idea. He'd never been asked. Obviously, he hadn't even been briefed that he might have been asked this question.
See, that's the interesting thing about this. Is that they come up with these stories, don't they? But they're just not clever enough to actually think their stories through. It's almost like children. You know, you put something down, a kid nicks it, and you say, you take that, and they go, no. But then they've got no explanation of where it's gone, have they? So who did it? And they go, we don't know, sort of thing. Whereas this is a bit like this, isn't it? You know, so where do you get the DNA samples from? Why didn't anybody think that? I mean, you'd think if you're going to do something like this, you'd try and kind of cover your tracks a bit.
Well, I mean, the poor guy just had no idea. And I almost felt sorry for him in the end. The presenter, he said, well, I don't know. And the presenter of the radio show said, well, no, you don't know, do you? And again, there was silence for 10 seconds, and it was very awkward. And you almost felt sorry for this guy, but he didn't know.
I don't think we should feel sorry for people who don't do their research. I think people who don't do their research deserve to be exposed like that.
Anyone who claims to work for some sort of engineering publication who doesn't know where the data came from, you really don't need to say very much more about it, to be honest.
But surely this has now become probably one of our strongest smoking guns.
How many smoking guns have we mentioned on the show today? Just to give you a flavour. This is only the tip of the iceberg of 9/11 stuff, basically. So
it's actually become a bit of a problem for me. Whenever you hear a speech, you just end up with a mountain of evidence that just cannot be mentioned, because literally you could speak for 12 hours straight on the amount of evidence that's available on the subject.
Absolutely, it's what I find when you do the 9/11 talk. You just got to do. I try to keep it very simple and keep to the very, very strong stuff. But there is such a range of stuff like that, and you tend to almost, because you focus on the very strong stuff, you tend to forget there is even sort of marginally less strong stuff, but nevertheless smoking guns out there like this stuff. I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it?
I just happen to know one personally, because at the time of 9/11 itself, I was actually involved in an international project involving urban search and rescue teams going to disasters in earthquake-prone countries like Iran and so forth. And there are lots and lots of teams around the world who are extremely good at this. They've got the dogs, they've got the listening devices, the heat-seeking cameras, they've got all the stuff you need to get people out of rubble. And there were teams in America wanting to go to the World Trade Center to help out, because they were going to need so many people in there if you're going to keep the search and rescue on a sustainable basis. That is basically one third in, one third resting, one third standby. Got to give the dogs a rest and everything else. And really good kosher teams were being stopped from going to the World Trade Center to get involved. And of course, when you're an urban search and rescue team, you are burying underneath. You are burrowing down to find out where survivors are or bodies are. And you have to ask, why were these teams being kept from the site? The only ones allowed in were the ones accredited by FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. And to me, that, I think, is a smoking gun that perhaps we ought to look at as well. It's just one of many.
Well, that's the news. It, for example, is a new smoking gun that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
So they keep propping up all the time.
Yeah.
And when was the last time you heard the fact that the stills were shipped off to China and melted down within 6 months? Things just get left out because there's so much stuff. It's difficult to keep track of how much evidence.
They interfered
in a crime scene, which of course is a criminal offence. But what's more interesting about that is they did actually forensicate a small amount. It's another smoking gun I found out about, which forensicated for sulphur, which indicated the presence of thermate, an explosive used in controlled demolition. So this is why they stopped doing the forensication, quite obviously. And, that's another smoking gun. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Common sense would have dictated, if that building collapsed, it wouldn't have collapsed right to the ground. You'd have had great big steel columns still standing and everything else.
Absolutely.
And everything was just cut to the right lengths to go on the trucks. Hey, come on. If I was in the studio now trying to justify the official conspiracy theory, I'd have given up a long time ago and walked out of the studio.
Yeah, because it's not just the fact that we've got very good evidence on our side, it's the fact that there is no evidence on their side. There is no evidence of these 13 hijackers. That's been admitted by the FBI. No evidence they could use in court, certainly admitted by the FBI. There was no, their names weren't on the flight manifest. There was no Arab DNA. We've heard reported as well, haven't we?
That's another new one for me.
So it's like, just goes on and on and on. So I don't, with people, all we've got to do, of course, is get them in front of the story and they will change their minds. But we're doing that increasingly, basically.
Mm. Yeah, I'd just like to add that Popular Mechanics did have a whole series of talks planned on various radio shows. But after that, well... Interesting, the way it panned out for them, they actually cancelled.
Well, that's it.
So we won't be hearing any more from Popular Mechanics.
Well, we had the same thing at the Oxford Union. The Oxford Union is the premier debating society in the world. The Americans want to get their message out. They could have done it there, because those kind of debates are picked up all the time by the nationals in this country. And when it came to the debate, we couldn't have a debate in the end because they wouldn't put up anyone against us, basically.
Can I just give you another smoking gun, which is again something I'm quite keen on, again to do with search and rescue, because obviously, as I said, I was quite involved in that side of things at the time. You've got a huge city like New York, skyscrapers and what have you. Fires do break out, towering inferno and all that. And people go to the top of the building, onto the actual top. Now, excuse me, where were the helicopters to come and try and rescue people from getting people out? Did you see any helicopters?
Well, this is the interesting thing. 9/11 Eyewitness does show, I think it's five helicopters going across.
Right.
And you can see this very clearly.
Yep.
Very clearly tracked across the thing. And they go towards the Twin Towers and they all go away again.
There's exactly. No attempt to try and any attempts up. At all by... I mean, you know, there will be urban search and... There will be search and rescue helicopters which will have the necessary ability to get hoist people up, winch people up. Where were they?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, standard procedure. You get at least two or three choppers in there to try and rescue people. Where were they?
Exactly. That's why I hadn't thought about it again. So there you go. One more, basically.
Could I just, related to this, how many Muslims now in this country, British Muslims, are facing the courts at the moment with actually ongoing trials and trials yet to come with all this recent activity of the anti-terrorist branch? To me, if I was on a jury and the defence team put out loose change to backed up with the sort of evidence we've been talking today, there's no way on earth I could convict those people. So, we as a truth movement have really got to make sure the defence teams embrace what we're saying because, the judge can't stop that sort of information from what you say they might. But,
they might try and stop it, absolutely. But yeah, I think that certainly the defence team has got to argue it. You're entitled to the best defence.
Absolutely.
And, it's not up to the lawyer to pick and choose. The lawyer's got to give you the best defence you can. And if there's stuff there that can help you, he's got to put it in his background. And the judge might seek to say this is inadmissible. But... I think that would be good because obviously this has to happen to a certain extent in open court, that decision, and therefore that decision would be reported across the world. So people would know that 9/11 had been ruled out of a court case, not on the grounds of the quality of the evidence, but simply because the judge just didn't want to hear it, basically. Yeah. And again, that's what we're going to do. I'm doing the same thing with my own court case, basically. I've got by the 22nd of September, we're going to put in a case for an appeal, not actually an appeal, for an appeal, but we're going to put the whole lot in, 9/11, 7/7. All the stuff about false flag terrorism, of course, my own experiences, and just say to the judges, look, the parallels in Nazi Germany are frightening. In the same way Hitler went to the courts and wanted them to suspend civil liberties, and of course that led to the Holocaust, you're faced with the same issue here. If you seek to carry on trying to enforce things like the Official Secrets Act and injunctions against me, you create the climate of fear about reporting about the intelligence services, you let them get away with it, basically. And then we've got the absolute proof of this with the invasion of Iraq and so on, that they can't do their jobs, that they can, all they do is manipulate information. Because so as I said, agents in MI5 are called reliable because they say what MI5 wants to hear. And we saw that with the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction dossier. The two guys who were saying, hang on, he's got no weapons of mass destruction, were thought to be unreliable agents, because they weren't saying what the intelligence services wanted to hear. And on that note, I just want to just mention very briefly my appearance on Heaven and Earth on Sunday morning on the God slot on BBC One. So the programme actually been on before, pre my spiritual conversion, in fact. And I went on there as the kind of atheist... humanist arguing that case particularly, and I was always quite amazed that many of my friends actually saw me on that programme. I only figured it out, not that they're all obsessed with God, but just they all would sit there in front of the television with hangovers on a Sunday morning channel hopping. Anyway, this time on the show, I wasn't actually in the studio in Manchester, I was actually in a studio in London, and they had on Peter Hitchin of the Mail on Sunday. And he, of course, was trying to poo-poo the 9/11 evidence. And I basically said to him, look, Peter, it's quite clear you haven't read the evidence. You really shouldn't be talking about it. One, because you make our job more difficult, but two, because you were going to make a fool of yourself. So I offered to say, look, I will show you the evidence. And, of course, in that circumstance, he had to say yes, so he's agreed to look at the evidence. So we're going to be arranging to meet him and asking him to be writing about it in his Mail on Sunday column, basically. But what I was particularly heartened by was when this happened, I heard Gloria Hunniford say, no, show us the evidence. So we're going to try and get back on the Heaven and Earth show with the 9/11 evidence, because obviously I was on there to argue that this is an issue of conscience. And I think if we can get Gloria Hunniford on side, who's really a national treasure in this country, the media are going to find it very, very difficult to keep that out of the papers, basically. I mean, the irony could be is that Gloria Hunniford could become our Charlie Sheen over here.
And, of course, the other thing, we've got to try and get the two archbishops on board, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York, because David Griffin has just written this new book, which I've got the title here, says he, trying to find it. It's down there. Can you get it? This is live radio for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's called Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11. And it's David Ray Griffin, A Call to Reflection and Action. And, of course, if we can get Christians on board as well, this movement's unstoppable, absolutely unstoppable. And the Archbishop of York, I'm going to talk to his own personal chaplain about this, and so I know that the Archbishop will be getting the book. And David Ray Griffin told me he was actually at a theological conference, university with the current Archbishop of Canterbury as well. So who knows? This is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what I said on the Heaven and Earth programme, on that sort of theme of Christianity. I did say to Peter Hitchings, he was trying to pretend that we shouldn't ever talk to people like Gerry Adams. And I was going to mention, I didn't mention it particularly clearly, but about, you know, obviously part of Christianity is forgiveness, of course, the central message. But of course, the other very clear message that comes out of the teachings of Jesus is the truth shall set you free.
Absolutely.
And that's what I said to him, the truth shall set you free. Anyway, on that note, remember, conquer the fear and embrace the love. That's all you need to know. Anyway, goodbye for another week. Cheerio for me and cheerio for my guests.
Good night. Cheerio.
Good night.
Good evening. Thank you. And may God bless you.
Good evening.
Cheers.